Support for the Legislative Gazette comes from United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President. UUPinfo.org.
Hundreds of families in Sullivan County have gone more than a year without child care assistance after the county's funding dried up last July. County officials announced plans to reopen the program on September 16th, but as the New York Public News Network's Kimberly Izar reports, some families are still turning to drastic measures to stay afloat.
Rose Chateau has a 3-year-old daughter, Dinah, and is expecting her family to grow in early December.
Yes, I'm currently 23 weeks pregnant, soon to go on 24. My daughter is 3.5. She's going to be almost 4 by the time this baby is born. And we found out we're having a boy.
Dinah loves toys, ice cream, and coloring. She says she's excited to do more of that with her baby brother.
What color is this one?
Blue.
Blue. I like blue. Do you like blue?
Yeah. And what is this?
This one. Oh, we went over this one.
This is black.
Black. Perfect. But Chateau, a Narrowsburg resident, says she's nervous since Sullivan County's child care assistance program has been closed for more than a year. This is New York State's program run by the Office of Children and Family Services that helps families pay for child care. Last July, Sullivan County closed its child care assistance program to new applications. County officials say the program was closed after they ran out of available money. County officials announced earlier this August that they plan to reopen the program to new applicants on September 16th. But the year-long pause has left hundreds of families like Chateau's suddenly without child care support for too long, she says. For her daughter, Dinah, it's meant cutting back daycare from 5 to 3 days.
So it was rough on her because she likes a set schedule and she misses her friends. And she'll tell me, I miss my friends, but there's nothing I can really do.
In 2023, Governor Kathy Hochul significantly expanded eligibility for the state's child care assistance program. While the state invested more funding in the program, it wasn't enough to keep up with increased demand. Sullivan County's program jumped from serving 150 children in 2023 to 650 children in 2025. Diana Wheely is the executive director of the Sullivan County Child Care Council. It's a nonprofit connecting parents to quality child care in the county. She said losing that support has been devastating for families.
Many families are making the choice to stop working. Some families are making the choice to put their child care on a credit card, hoping the program will open soon enough. Other families are going to providers, and providers are not getting paid because they feel bad about these families having to work and having no funding to pay for it.
New York State is among the most expensive states in the country for child care. The market rate for weekly daycare for a child under a year and a half is $320 a week in Sullivan and Delaware counties. Chateau says the costs quickly add up.
So the cost is like another car payment. I mean, we're still paying off her car. I don't remember if I said this last time, but I had to try to save up to get my roof fixed. And because I found out I was pregnant, we decided, okay, let's take out a loan. And now that's another payment I have to pay off. So there's the car payment, the loan for the roof, and, you know, just making sure we have a roof over our head, literally.
The pause has also left many child care providers in a tough spot. At Sweet Angel Daycare in Harris, the daycare floor is covered with colorful foam tiles and lots of toys on the ground. Owner Deirdre Migliaccio beams with excitement showing me around.
We have a lot of, we try to hit a lot of sensory stuff, you know. We got squishy stuff, you know, they love this. These are little puppet guys and they're like squishy.
Migliaccio opened her daycare last September, 2 months after the child care assistance program closed in Sullivan County.
I would get calls and they would say, well, you know, do you know if they're going to bring the subsidy back anytime soon? There's no way I can do it without it. And I would have to say, I don't know. I really don't know about that. I was really bummed about that because I was getting these calls and I'm like, what? Oh my gosh. It was like, I got to say about three families who just said, look, I can't do it without the subsidy. Yeah. It was rough. It was rough hearing that. I felt bad and I lowered my rates. I brought them down as low as I possibly could. And, I wasn't taking deposits, anything that would, help them maybe get another week out of me, that kind of thing.
Migliaccio said one family had to pull their toddler out of the daycare entirely after losing their subsidies. New York has nearly doubled Sullivan County's allocation for the upcoming fiscal year from $3 to $5.9 million. Dan Hoos, Sullivan County's communications director, says the county will keep a close eye on available funding as they prepare to reopen the program in mid-September.
Our folks are going to continually monitor funding as we authorize cases so that we try to mitigate before we suddenly find out we're out of money.
But Chateau says families have needed support for more than a year. She says she's contacted her elected officials, including Congressmember Josh Riley and Governor Hochul, to ensure there is sustainable funding moving forward. For now, she's waiting on the program to reopen for Dinah and her soon-to-be baby brother.
This is a bipartisan issue. Democrat, Republican, Independent, it doesn't matter. This is for the kids. And I think this is so important for Sullivan County to help our kids and help our local parents.
In Liberty, I'm Kimberly Izar for the New York Public News Network.
Listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. This week I sat down with Yancey Roy, Albany Bureau Chief for Newsday, to talk about a federal judge ruling that New York State cannot charge fossil fuel companies for their role in causing climate change.
The Climate Act, which was passed in 2024, it did a lot of things, including setting goals, but one of the things it also did was set the grounds where the state could seek money, and a lot of money, from companies that extracted or refined fossil fuels, and the use of fossil fuels, of course, contributing to greenhouse gas emissions for decades and decades. Part of the provision of the law would be that companies would be on the hook for some of the costs that the state had to endure for fossil fuels. And we're talking like $75 billion. So it is a lot of money. Not surprisingly, a group of litigants tried to challenge it. It was not just the American Petroleum Institute, the National Mining Association. It was also the Chamber of Commerce of the United States. It was the Business Council of New York State. There were various plaintiffs, also often from red states such as West Virginia and others, trying to block this law. So it's in federal court. And at the first stop, the Northern District in Syracuse, a judge ruled for the plaintiffs, the Chambers of Commerce and the Petroleum Institute, and et cetera, basically saying that the Climate Change Superfund Act went too far, that the New York State legislature more or less overstepped its bounds in trying to weigh in on what should be more or less a federal issue. And the federal issue here is dominant, and therefore the law was struck down. This doesn't mean it's the end of the chapter. Almost all lawsuits get appealed. And so this will go from the Northern District likely to the Second Circuit Court of Appeals in New York City. But that's going to take a long time before it gets to there. So it leaves a bit of a question mark about the climate law and also the cost for energy supply, offsetting greenhouse gases and pollution. A fight that will continue on well beyond this governor's election.
It certainly seems like we're all fiddling while Rome burns.
Again, it's going to take a little bit of a time before this is resolved.
We're seeing glaciers collapse and floods killing people. We're seeing the Grand Canyon flash flooding. We're seeing fires in Canada and the smoke coming over the Northeast. We're seeing all the evidence all around us of climate change, and yet we humph and we fumph and we make court decisions and we say we can't do this. Meanwhile, as the countries engage in a war with Iran and the Strait of Hormuz is clogged up and the prices for fossil fuels rise, these companies that now are told by a judge they're not going to be charged are making trillions.
Well, in terms of the legal issue, it's not the first time that states like either California or New York and Vermont also has this similar climate law where they're charging the companies. It's not the first time where states have tried to lead the way or push the rest of the states into action, especially California is often known for that. But a judge to come in and say, wait a minute, this is an issue that regardless of what side you're on, it obviously involves the entire country and a lot of states, and one state can't simply pass a law without federal action. But we'll have to see how that plays out.
And based on the head of the Environmental Protection Agency and the others running climate issues in this country right now, I can't see where that's going to happen. All right, Nancy, now how does this issue with the climate law jive with Governor Kathy Hochul's move to put an executive order and moratorium for a year on the construction of data centers in New York?
The governor did that this summer, and it's proved, at least so far, pretty popular, I think, with the residents of New York State. The data centers are these structures that want to generate, use a lot of power to especially keep up with the computing needs of AI, artificial intelligence, and you're seeing them being built all over the country and in states where there's an easier regulatory climate than New York. New York has put a one-year moratorium on them, again, and they've had listening roundtables, if you will, around New York, and I think the governor has been touting this because it is pretty popular right now because people are unsure about energy use, about the impact on local communities, about whether these things will bring any jobs, really, whatsoever. Bruce Blakeman, her opponent, the Republican county executive from Nassau County, has said he would leave it up to individual communities to decide. If a community wants to host something, they should host it. He thinks that a blanket moratorium is not the answer. Of course, 1 year is going to be up in no time, so this issue is going to be back again in a year, regardless of who's governor. But it also ties into one of the things that Blakeman is trying to make about his campaign, which is the cost of living in New York is too high. It's been a complaint by politicians and residents for a long time. Blakeman is trying to say that Hochul is responsible for rising utility bills, rising grocery prices. Hochul has been batting that back by saying things like Donald Trump's tariffs on Canada, the war in the Middle East are the things that are driving up the prices, not anything that New York State in and of itself is doing.
Well, Yancey, there are so many ways to go here. You've given me avenues to go down. Okay. So Hochul has her own affordability agenda, right? This is what she's been all about. So part of the reason that she delayed some of these climate goals was because it was going to be unaffordable for New Yorkers when the utilities would raise the costs of energy. So she did that. And she was also concerned, because she told me this, about water use and the pollution of water. There's an environmental issue when it comes to data centers. So she's worried about the environment there, but she's also pushed back on the environmental goals. So is there any contradiction there?
That's a question probably best put to Kathy Hochul. How does she sort through that? But if you're trying to sift through it, I think what they would probably say is the difference is between what's the long-term goal, such as getting companies to pay for greenhouse gas, getting data centers to pay their share of costs and impact on the environment when they want to move in somewhere, and the short-term, more immediate issues of can, and I say short-term as in can New York reach a certain percentage of its energy supply from green energy by 2030, which is just a little over 3 years away, and everybody's saying, no, it's just not doable. So why keep some pie-in-the-sky goal that can't be met that might have some regulatory impacts on cost. If it's just impossible, we need to adjust that. So I think that's how they would sift through that. But again, whether New York residents or activists on either side are buying that, we'll find out a little bit when the election comes. But I think that's what they would say is the difference between what are the long-term goals for clean energy in New York and using less fossil fuels versus what's on the ground practically doable in about 3 years.
That's Yancey Roy, Albany Bureau Chief for Newsday. You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. More than 1,100 people at last report have died from the flash floods that swept through Himalayan communities in Nepal last week. Legislative Gazette's Sajina Shrestha, who was in Nepal at the time, reports on what she saw and how the Nepalese community in Albany has been affected.
Rasuwa was one of the districts located in northern Nepal, which was hit hardest by the flood. I was in the capital, Kathmandu, about 6 to 8 hours away from that district when the floods began. But even hundreds of miles away, the flood was on everybody's mind. A cab driver told me he was worried because he hadn't heard from a friend in the neighboring district. A shopkeeper told me she was kept up late into the night as she saw more and more videos from the flood emerge. When you called someone in Nepal, instead of a ringtone, you'd get a PSA about the flood and the regions impacted. With rescue efforts underway and access to the impacted areas being limited, it seemed like everyone in Kathmandu was waiting with bated breath as the casualty numbers continued to rise. In a Hindu temple outside Albany, thousands of miles away from Nepal, the same bated breath and anxiety could be found at a candle vigil held by the local Nepalese community. For Latham resident Jagdish Thakal, thinking about the flood felt overwhelming at times.
Well, if I really like start talking about it, it makes me really emotional. But like if I just try to like avoid it, because you know, like, and if I not think about it, like I obviously don't get emotional. Yeah, there's nothing else I can do. I mean, it's just nature.
Thakal's home district of Nuwakot is about 35 miles from Rasuwa. He says the flood's impact was so huge, he did not think it was real when he first saw it.
First, I thought it was just AI and like someone was just trying to like get attention and grab views. But then I looked into more and I just couldn't believe like my hometown, like the place where I like grew up, like where I went to school, like where I made so many friends, like, you know, like just being like swept away by the flood. Like, it makes me really emotional, actually.
Thakal says he's unsure how his town will ever return to normal after such a drastic flood. For now, he is urging his community to donate to relief efforts as he checks in with friends and family. Ujjal Lamithani, the director of communications for the Albany, New York Nepalese Society, says many in the community feel somber as they await for news from Nepal.
Many of us, even though we are thousands of miles away from the home, our heart is over there. We have been looking at the videos coming from the Nepal, and everybody is saddened with that incident to happen. And everybody today are not feeling the joy or happiness. They are just feeling the same. They are sharing the same emotions that the impacted people had back home.
With rescue efforts underway and casualty numbers increasing by the day, many Nepalese in the capital region, much like the Nepalese back in Kathmandu, say there is an air of worry and sadness as they watch and wait. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Sajina Shrestha.
There was a rare agreement among members of the Oswego County Legislature this week. Majority Republicans and minority Democrats brought together by one thing. As Dave Bullard with the New York Public News Network reports, they were unified in opposing the name change for Lake Ontario.
We're going to be changing the name of Lake Ontario, effective immediately, to Lake
America.
That order went over like a lead sailboat in some of Lake Ontario's waterfront communities, but it was surprising that a rebuke, a mild one, mind you, came from one of the reddest corners of the region, Oswego County, run uninterrupted by the Republican Party for many decades. The county lies at the elbow of Lake Ontario. Fishing, boating, waterfront recreation, these are serious industries here. The port of Oswego is vital for keeping a major employer supplied with aluminum ingots. It's in the name of a conference center, a subtitle for the famous Rudy's Fish Fry stand, gives the Lake Ontario Wine Trail its name. The lake is even a major push for the county's own tourism office. So when a resolution came before a legislature subcommittee on Monday, legislators from both sides lined up to support it. That resolution says the county is going to go on calling it Lake Ontario, regardless of the executive order. Legislator Patty Holst.
I feel that it's our responsibility to keep expenses at bay, not only for the county, but for our constituents, small businesses, large businesses.
Legislature Chair Jim Weatherup, a Republican who is running for an open state assembly seat this fall, chose a middle path.
I am deeply concerned about how this affects our tourism and our trade partners with Canada, such as Novelis. But having said that, lots of names change.
In fact, the resolution explicitly says the county recognizes and respects the authority of the federal government when it comes to federal naming, even as it prefers the historical significance of a Lake Ontario name. Democrat Lee Walker said there was no reason to change that name to begin with.
I was born here, city of Oswego. I live in a seven-generation house. Just living it to this day. I'm going to die here. As far as I'm concerned, it will always, always be Lake Ontario.
One legislator wondered what legislators would do if the Trump administration pressured them. The prevailing sentiment, though, was that they would see what happens and decide then. For the New York Public News Network, I'm Dave Bullard.
You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. Forest researchers are anticipating a slow start to New York and New England's fall foliage season, leading to extended and vibrant colors across the landscape. The New York Public News Network's Pat Bradley with more.
Yankee Magazine has issued its prediction for the upcoming fall foliage season. Leaf peepers are expected to see tree canopies with bright colors. The magazine's fall foliage forecaster, Jim Salgi, explains how he calculates the season's potential.
There's a number of things that go into it, but really in August, we're trying to assess how healthy the forest is at this point in the year. And this year, we've come out of the drought really successfully in New England, and we've had a lot less insect pressures and funguses. So we're really optimistic about what this year may bring.
Vermont Department of Forest, Parks and Recreation Forest Health Program Manager Josh Hallman expects a good foliage season in Vermont.
For most of the growing season, we had good rain, and trees have been healthy. August has been a little drier, so we're starting to see some stressed trees showing a little bit of color already, but that's typical. And again, this year we're seeing that in certain locations, not everywhere.
A drought impacted areas of New England last year. Salgi says while the multi-state region has mostly rebounded, there are still places that have significant groundwater deficits that may affect color.
Eastern Massachusetts, the coast of Maine, they're a little bit more dry than we'd like going into the season. But overall, it's really hard to have a bad foliage year in New England, and I think even those areas are going to be beautiful. This year, we have a bit of an El Nino pattern that should extend our season. So things progressing about on time in the northern areas and a bit late in the south, really extending a nice fall foliage season.
While weather patterns throughout the year have been favorable for the emergence of color, Hallman says it's a bit early to determine which species will produce the brightest leaves and when that will happen.
Red maple will start turning somewhat early if they're in wetter areas or higher elevations or more northern latitudes. What we've seen from those few trees that have started changing color is that color looks great. Some sugar maples have been impacted by some fungal diseases. Some of the sugar maples that have these fungal issues going on might be a little more muted this year, but it's not a widespread statewide issue that would be affecting all maples.
This year, Vermont saw no outbreaks of insects or invasives that defoliate trees, so most trees are expected to present brilliant colors. Sal G is concerned about beech leaf disease, which is spreading across New England.
It's spread by the wind. It's a microscopic nematode that seems to be cold tolerant in all but the coldest regions, and it's just really wreaked havoc region-wide.
Sal G says it has been one of the most rapid expansions of an invasive in New England's forests.
The beeches have a yellow-orange hue that really hangs on late in the year. So people who are missing peak and coming late often see a lingering golden glow to the forests. And we're really worried that that's going to be a thing of the past with this new disease.
Beech trees are a significant component of Vermont's northern hardwood forest. Hallman says the disease was first detected in southern counties of Vermont in 2023, and they have not yet seen a decline in beech tree health.
So not really expecting to see much issue with fall color with beech trees in Vermont related to beech leaf disease this year. As it progresses, we might start seeing more stress on those beech trees. And when beech trees get stressed, they really light up. It's almost like a lemon yellow color. Although not a really good thing for the trees whatsoever, it is a pretty striking color that you'll see on the landscape.
It's typically mid to late September when widespread foliage colors emerge, with peak color occurring in early October. In Plattsburgh, I'm Pat Bradley for the New York Public News Network.
And that about does it for this week's show. The Legislative Gazette is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio. We had help from the New York Public News Network. You can listen anytime at WAMCpodcast.org or anywhere you get your podcasts. Look for program number 2636 and join us again next week at this same time for the Legislative Gazette. I'm David Gustino.
Support for the Legislative Gazette comes from United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President. UUPinfo.org.